Análisis Viva, el primer podcast en español donde los analistas económicos más reconocidos se dan cita para revisar lo más relevante en materia económico-financiera en México y el mundo. Análisis Viva.
¿Qué tal? Bienvenidas, bienvenidos. Mi nombre es Salvador Leal, director de comunicación de la Bolsa Institucional de Valores, y les doy la bienvenida a este episodio especial de la cuarta temporada del podcast semanal Análisis Viva. No olviden seguirnos en todas nuestras redes sociales para mantenerse enterados de lo más relevante de los mercados en nuestro país. El día de hoy tenemos un episodio muy especial en el que les compartiremos la charla que dio recientemente Richard Clarida, asesor económico de PIMCO y ex vicepresidente de la Fed del 2018 al 2022. Aquí en el Auditorio Viva nos platicó sobre las perspectivas económicas y la toma de decisiones de la Fed para el 2023. Escuchemos su presentación.
Good morning, everyone. Hi. Welcome to Viva and our Viva Auditorium. We're really pleased to have you here, dear estimated guest. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this fireside chat sponsored by PIMCO with no one other than Rich Clarida, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and PIMCO's global economic advisor. Welcome, Rich. Thank you for being here with us. I am Santiago Salinas, Director for Institutional Relations and Government Affairs, and also Maria, our CEO, sending her greetings. And we are really honored to have you here and to have this opportunity to engage in a meaningful conversation with someone so esteemed and with a lot of knowledge as Mr. Clarida. With his wealth of experience in macroeconomics, monetary policy, and financial markets, we are sure to gain valuable insights that will help shape our understanding of the current economic landscape. At Viva, we are committed to promote a dynamic and transparent stock market that helps drive economic growth here in Mexico and also in LATAM. Our vision is to be a platform that empowers investors to make informed decisions, drives innovation, and contributes to sustainable development of our economy. We believe that engaging with experts like Mr. Clarida is an essential part of achieving this vision. By learning from those who have played key roles in shaping global financial markets, we can gain a deeper understanding of the challenges and opportunities that we have ahead. I want to acknowledge PIMCO for having selected the Viva Auditorium as the venue for this so important event and helping make it possible. Thank you very much. We are really honored to partner with this organization that shares our commitment to promoting transparency and building a strong and sustainable finance market. I'm sure we are all very excited to be in this conversation with Mr. Clarida and look forward to hearing his insights on the state of the global economy, the future of monetary policy, and the role of the financial markets in this driving and growing economy. It's really also a pleasure for me to present Barbara Clancy, Executive Vice President and Head of PIMCO Latin America and the Caribbean, and co-head of PIMCO New York office. Barbara is responsible for setting strategic direction for Latin American region, leading a team of PIMCO professionals to deliver innovative solutions and the best-in-class services to Latin America. Welcome, everyone, and thanks, Barbara. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Santiago, for that introduction, and thank you, all of our partners at Viva, for allowing us to host this event today. As you can see, it's a full room, and it's so great to be here in Mexico City with all of you, our clients, investors, you know, various relationships that we have. As Santiago mentioned, we're here with Dr. Rich Clarida, and we're so honored to be able to have him here in Mexico City. And just a little bit more background on Rich, who rejoined PIMCO last year after a four-year term as the vice chairman of the Board of Governors at the U.S. Federal Reserve. Rich had actually spent a big part of his career at PIMCO prior to 2018 as PIMCO's global strategic advisor, and he was the key architect of PIMCO's new neutral hypothesis or new neutral thesis, which really defined how PIMCO thought about financial markets in the period after 2014, where we saw extremely low interest rates across global economies, global markets. So again, thank you all for the time today. Really excited that Rich is here with us in his capacity as PIMCO Global Economic Advisor. And we hope you find the conversation today to be interesting and informative. Before we jump into the topics about the Fed and monetary policy and inflation, which we know are top of mind, I thought we could just spend a few minutes with Rich sharing with us, what are you doing at PIMCO today? Tell us a little bit more about how you interact with the PIMCO Investment Committee and our investment process.
Well, Barbara, thank you for that, and thank you to our host for a lovely venue and perfect weather, so you get all credit for everything. I've had an opportunity to visit this fine city over the years, but never in the month of February, so certainly this has been a treat. Well, it was a real treat for me as well to return to PIMCO in October. I spent nearly 14 years there between 2005 and 2018. And in some ways, my role at PIMCO is similar in many respects to what I was doing before. There are really three pieces of it, Barbara. One is I oversee our secular forum process. So every year, PIMCO carves out a week, typically in May, to bring in outside speakers and all the investment professionals to Newport Beach to think ahead and try to see where the world economy and markets are going over the next 3 to 5 years. That you were kind enough to mention the new neutral thesis. Before that, we had the new normal. So that's a big part of the investment process. I am a member of the investment committee as well. You know, I stick to my knitting, as we say in America, and just focused on the macro and the central banking call, but hope to inform our investment committee on how those factors play into our investing. And another important piece of my job is getting around the world and seeing clients and prospects and both conveying our views and listening to your thoughts. So I'm very happy to be back and look forward to the conversation.
Great. Thank you, Rich. Well, let's go back in time for a little bit, and I've heard you say this a couple times recently, in order to talk about what we expect for the Fed and for monetary policy, it's important to cover how did we get here? So take us back in time to 2020, 2021, when you were vice chairman, and how were you thinking about inflation and the outlook back then, and then we can lead into, you know, what we expect from here.
You're absolutely right. There is path dependence in monetary policy, as I found out as vice chair. So to have a sense of what Jay Powell and the Fed are going to do at the March meeting, it's useful to have some context for how we got to this point. And let me just quickly rewind the tape. Every country in the world, including Mexico, went through an enormous dislocation in 2020, the pandemic shutting down the global economy. In the U.S., 22 million jobs were lost in 2 months, so essentially 10 years of employment gains wiped out in 2 months in the spring of 2020. GDP collapsed at a 30% annualized pace, an even steeper pace of decline than the Great Depression. And the Fed and fiscal authorities were all in, and without apology. The shock was immense. I can tell you, Barbara, that in March of 2020, there were no vaccines. It was not clear there would ever be vaccines. If you're thinking about a financial system and you're thinking about the possibility of shutting down the economy, say, for 6 months or a year, what does a financial system look like if there are no revenues to make payments on debt? So under Jay Powell's leadership, we decided to go all in and did a number of big things. But fundamentally, the announcement of fact that we were prepared to go all in to support the markets, as well as a big fiscal package, meant that the decline, although steep, was very short-lived, and the economy began to rebound in 2020. We came into 2021 with the recognition that vaccines were now available, were being distributed. But we also came into the year, Barbara, understanding that in 2020, the net effect of both shutting down the economy and the support provided by policy was disinflationary. Inflation actually fell in 2020. A lot of folks don't remember that. And initially, we believed that the economy could reopen pretty smoothly. We knew there was a lot of demand in the economy from accommodative monetary policy and fiscal, but there was also a lot of available supply. There were, you know, tens of millions of workers who were still unemployed. And for about the first 6 months or so of 2021, the data was consistent with that. But certainly by the second half of the year, the economy began to, we began to see broad-based inflation in labor and in goods markets. And so fundamentally what happened, Barbara, at the simplest level, is that the Fed got aggregate supply wrong in the economy. We began to hit a tight labor market with an unemployment rate of 5%. It had been 3.5% before the pandemic with no inflation pressure. And so the Fed recognized in the fall of 2021 that it needed to begin removing accommodation and tightening, and that gets us really to where we are today. So last year, a very aggressive rate hike cycle by Jay Powell and the committee, the most aggressive increase in rates, most rapid since 1980. In terms of the outlook for the economy, we do think most of the heavy lifting the Fed needs to do on policy, it's already done. And notwithstanding some of the noisy recent data, we also think that we've seen peak inflation. So I think that sets us up well for the remainder of the conversation.
Great. Thank you, Rich. And you talked a bit about this already in terms of, you know, inflation starting to moderate, although we did see several data points in January and February that came in quite hot, right? CPI, retail sales, PCE, which is the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. So as we think about the next few months, how would you describe, you know, the Fed's and Powell's reaction function to that data, and how could that inform what we see in the next few meetings?
Exactly. So I think part of what the Fed, and I think we and financial markets are trying to do now, is to extract signal from the noisy data we've been getting. There were some seasonal adjustment issues in the data that probably means some of that hot inflation is a bit of a statistical artifact. But I do think the Powell Fed is in risk management mode, as the chair has said many times. The risk of doing too little in terms of tightening exceeds the risk of doing too much. At minimum, I think we will see the Fed delivering the rate hikes that it indicated it would in December. That would be 25 basis points at the March meeting. That would get the funds rate up to 5%. Another 25 basis points at the May meeting. That would get the funds rate to 5.25%. And they will certainly leave the door open to going beyond that, in particular to hiking in June. Indeed, as I looked at my screen a day or two ago, I've been traveling, it looked like the markets have essentially priced in 100% chance that of an additional 25 basis point hike at the June meeting. That being said, I think Jay Powell will want optionality. I think at this point, Fed central bankers, and not just at the Fed, but the ECB and the Bank of England talk a lot, and here in Mexico occasionally, talk about the importance of being data dependent. I think sometimes data dependent is more relevant than at others. But I do think now, looking ahead for the Fed, I think if inflation stabilizes and begins to come down on the path that we saw at the end of next year, they could well be done at the June meeting. Certainly, our view is that we've seen peak inflation, but it's also the case that the labor market is still running very hot, and we've yet to see really any indications of a softening in the labor market. And the longer that goes on, the more concerned I think the Fed will be about perhaps needing to do even more.
Thank you, Rich. So you mentioned pause potentially at some point in the middle of the year, presumably for the Fed to have an opportunity to observe what has been some of the impact of this very significant move in policy rates. And this is something that has been surprising in that, you know, rates moved significantly, but we haven't yet seen as much of an impact on the labor market in particular. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, this comment, the variable and lagged effects of monetary policy? When will we start to see some of that impact of, you know, pretty restrictive policy, and where should we be looking for some of that impact?
Exactly. So if you've taken an economics course, you may have come across this quote attributed to Milton Friedman, that monetary policy operates with, quote, long and variable lags. As a former policymaker, I can certainly say that the lags are variable. I'm not quite sure how long they are. And in particular, I think there are cases, there's an argument made on both sides. But what we do know is the Fed tightened rates very aggressively last year. According to their own metrics, they have moved rates into restrictive territory. You know, if you want to buy a car, you want to build a house, you want to get a loan to grow your business, you're paying much higher rates than you were a year ago. So financial conditions are tighter. And, you know, estimates would indicate that the maximum impact of that has yet to be felt. I would point out, importantly, that last year the economy slowed sharply. So in 2021, GDP growth was near 6%. And last year, it downshifted to about 1%. So I sometimes get frustrated when I see commentary online or on television about the economy's not yet slowing. The economy's slowed a lot. What has not yet really slowed is the labor market. And historically, getting to the concept that you mentioned, Barbara, the labor market is a classic lagging indicator of the economy. What that means is that by the time you begin to see the unemployment rate move up materially, the economy is already either in or close to being in a recession. So I wouldn't put 100% focus on the tight labor market. I would also point out that we did get some good news last year that so far has not been revised away, which is that we did see a pretty material deceleration in wage inflation towards the end of last year. In particular, when in 2021, wages were going up around 6% in the economy. And you don't have to have a PhD in economics to know that if wages are going up 6%, it's going to be hard to hit a 2% inflation target since wages are 60 or 70% of cost of companies. But wage inflation toward the end of 2022 downshifted to about 4% pace. Now, that's still somewhat faster than the Fed would like. They would like wage inflation somewhere in the threes. But so long as that doesn't get revised away, even though employment is still strong, we are seeing some indications of disinflation in the labor market.
And following up on the labor market comment, how has the labor market changed? And do you see that influencing the Fed's, you know, policy decisions? There's been a lot of talk of, you know, participation rates falling, especially with the 55-year-old and up cohort, and just other perhaps more structural changes that occurred as a result of the pandemic. Can you just walk through, you know, how why is the labor market so resilient? Perhaps some of it is because of some of the changes or other factors.
Yeah, indeed. So when I arrived at the Fed in the September of 2018, excuse me, to get some water here. When I arrived at the Fed in September of 2018, the labor market was also surprising us, but in a very positive and favorable direction. So the Fed's economic models had indicated that once the unemployment rate fell below 5%, we would see a big pickup in inflation, and we didn't see it. And I will give the Fed that I was a participant of, and Jay Powell as chair, I'm proud of the fact that we looked through the models and allowed the labor market to achieve a 50-year low in unemployment. In January of 2020, the month before the pandemic hit, the U.S. unemployment rate was 3.5%, a 50-year low. Wage gains were solid but not inflationary. And so it is fair to say that although we knew in 2021 the post-pandemic economy could look different, our working hypothesis was that the labor market eventually would return to looking like the pre-pandemic labor market, and we were simply wrong. And not just in the U.S. If you read commentary from the ECB or the Bank of England and other central banks, I'm not as attuned here in Mexico, but many central banks have noticed a much tighter labor market and much less supply in the labor market post pandemic. Prime age participation has returned roughly to the level that prevailed before the pandemic, but the overall size of the labor force is millions less than you would have predicted pre-pandemic for a couple of reasons. One, as Barbara mentioned, we had what we call in the U.S. the great resignation of folks who were 55 and older during the pandemic. They have just not come back into the labor force. Secondly, immigration collapsed into the U.S. towards the end of the last administration and then obviously during COVID. And then thirdly, as Jay Powell mentioned, it's not pleasant, but it's arithmetic. You know, hundreds of thousands of workers died as a result of COVID. So if you add those three together, the economy is operating with a much scarcer supply of labor than was the case before the pandemic. And what that has meant is that the Fed now is penciling in through its projections that in order to bring down inflation into the range that they want, they foresee that there's going to have to be a rise in the unemployment rate of at least one percentage point. And so that will be part of the adjustment process in order to get inflation down into the twos.
And that's a good segue to my next question, because it's related to that balance between bringing down inflation while still achieving maximum employment, and ultimately, what does this mean for growth? So as we look ahead, what are your thoughts on soft landing, hard landing, or the more recent no landing? How does this all play out from a growth perspective?
Well, a little bit of a comment on the no landing. It's getting a lot of currency these days. I was asked this question a week or so ago on CNBC, and I was very definitive, so I'll be definitive with you. There will be a landing. The no landing thesis is essentially the Powell Fed's going to give up on disinflation and will accept an inflation rate of 4%+. Because they don't want to do what it takes to get inflation down. There will be a landing. The only question is, will it be a soft landing, a softish landing, or a hard landing? So let's talk about each of those three. So in a truly soft landing, the Fed is able to raise rates and reduce demand growth to put it in line with supply growth. It slows growth below trend, but not into negative territory. And you get a rise in the unemployment rate as well, but not so significant. And in that, you get inflation down and you avoid even a technical recession. What I've been calling a softish landing, really now for about a year, is a scenario whereby you slow growth, but perhaps have a couple of quarters with slightly negative growth. And you get a rise in the unemployment rate comparable to what we saw in some of the milder recession, say a point and a quarter or so. But for the calendar year as a whole, 2023 GDP growth is still positive. Now, because of the way that recessions are defined in the U.S., that scenario probably would be designated technically as a recession in the U.S. Because historically, whenever the unemployment rate has risen more than 0.5%, that's coincided with the designation of a recession. What I would say is that if a year from now we're doing this event and we look back and we see that in 2023, that GDP growth was positive and that the unemployment rate was somewhere in the fours, I think I would consider that a softish landing, even though technically it might be a recession. And then finally, the hard landing is as it indicates, very aggressive rate increases, probably much more than we've seen priced in right here, and a sharp slowdown and deep, or certainly material recession with probably a 2 to 2.5 percentage point rise in the unemployment rate. So that would be the hard landing scenario.
And from PIMCO's base case view, we're more in that revised soft landing version.
The softish landing, yeah.
Yeah. So a few more questions on the macro, and then we'll turn to a few other topics. And this is really related more to the dollar, the U.S. dollar. And obviously, it was very strong last year as the Fed was hiking rates. But just walk us through, how does the Fed take that into account, the strength of the dollar and the impact that can have on, you know, the global liquidity picture and just, you know, markets globally?
It's a great question, Barbara, because it's often misunderstood. Part of it is institutionally in the U.S., the dollar policy, to the extent there is a dollar policy, and decisions on currency intervention are solely the purview of the Treasury Secretary. So the Fed doesn't talk about exchange rates as much as you might think, not because they're unimportant or it's not focusing on them, but they're very, very sensitive of not being perceived as upstaging the Treasury Secretary. I think Janet Yellen, when she was chair, did a very good job in some of her speeches at laying out the way the Fed does think about the exchange rate. So the Fed understands that the exchange rate impacts the dollar exchange rate impacts the U.S. economy across different channels, and also that monetary policy is transmitted in part through the exchange rate. So the Fed knows that when it eases policy, we'll tend to get a weaker dollar, and when it tightens policy, we'll get a stronger dollar. And those tend to move in the directions that are consistent with its objectives. If you tighten policy, you get a stronger dollar that lowers the price of imports, reduces the demand for exports, and vice versa. The Fed also, frankly, benefits from the fact that although the U.S. economy is enormous, it's relatively less exposed to trade than many other countries. For example, imports as a share of GDP. In addition, the U.S., because it's the provider of the global reserve currency, has a very special privilege, which is that it can actually borrow trillions of dollars from the rest of the world denominated in its own currency. And secondly, a lot of U.S. imports are invoiced in dollars, which sounds technical. But what that essentially means is that when the dollar changes to a first instance, it doesn't change imported inflation very much. Very unusual. The U.K., Mexico, most countries in the world, when their currency moves a lot, it shows up pretty promptly in consumer prices through import prices. And then finally, the U.S., the Fed understands that moves in the dollar also impact other economies. A lot of international trade is invoiced in dollars. A lot of international borrowing and lending is indexed in dollars. So the Fed certainly does think about and assess how its policies influence the dollar. But at least in my experience, both as a policymaker and Fed observer, in rare exceptions in the last 30 years, it's not really had a particular view on the dollar that it would defend through intervention or the like.
Great. Thank you. That's helpful. Next question, and going back to some of your earlier comments on Fed policy and obviously the rates being highly restrictive and having, you know, we're coming off a very aggressive rate hiking cycle last year. A question we often get from investors is around quantitative tightening. And what is, you know, what is the true impact of that? And also, why isn't the Fed doing more as it relates to using that tool, especially given that, you know, at least recently, some of the inflation data has been more hotter than expected?
Great question, because it is certainly on the mind of investors. So quantitative tightening at its simplest way to think about it is that it's the reverse of quantitative easing. So when the Fed is buying Treasury and buying mortgage-backed securities, that's what we call quantitative easing. That does two things. It increases the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and it adds reserves to the banking system, because when the Fed buys a bond, it pays for it with a check, and when you deposit that check in the bank, that's a liability of the bank, but it's an asset because they have a reserve account at the Fed. So QT works in the opposite direction. When the Fed shrinks its portfolio, it's draining reserves from the banking system. Now, there are different ways to do QT. The way the Fed does it is a passive approach, whereby it's not selling any assets. It's just not reinvesting proceeds when existing assets mature. And that's very predictable because we know down to the QSIP all of the treasuries the Fed owns. So we know how rapidly the treasury portfolio runs off. The Fed also has a big mortgage portfolio. It has purchased a lot of mortgage-backed securities. And those are somewhat less predictable in their prepayments. Right now the Fed is letting its balance sheet run off about $80 billion a month, so about $1 trillion a year. That sounds like a lot, but between March of 2020 and March of 2022, the Fed's balance sheet went up by about $4.5 trillion. So the Fed has the, but there's another approach you can take, and this is the approach actually that the Bank of England takes in its quantitative tightening program, which is that it's actually selling assets. It's not waiting for them to mature. The Fed has considered asset sales in the past, as we know from the minutes. That is certainly something that is not on the radar screen right now, and the chair's been asked about that. But that would be one tool in the toolkit if the Fed wanted to tighten financial conditions further. In addition to raising the overnight federal funds rate, it could more aggressively run off its portfolio. A final complication, and then I'll pause because we could get very much into the weeds on this, is that the Fed about a decade ago set up a facility called a reverse repurchase facility. And to cut to the chase, what that facility does is it essentially enables money market mutual funds to lend to the Fed and thus drain reserves from the banking system. It's a little convoluted because by statute, the Fed is the only institution who can have a deposit account at the Fed is a commercial bank. And so the Fed came up with a vehicle which is essentially equivalent to a deposit, but technically it's structured as a loan. Now, that facility, when it was introduced in a decade ago, I think at its peak got up to about $400 billion. And then as soon as the Fed started raising rates in 2016, it quickly shrank to zero because the money market funds can find better things to do with their money than lend to the Fed in a rising rate environment. But that's not been the case in this cycle. So the reverse repo facility now is north of $2 trillion, even though the overnight interest rates are close to 5%. And the reason why that's important is that if that facility remains bloated, then that will, over time, cut short the length of time over which the Fed can do its QT program. And so although we know a lot about the pace at which the Fed's balance sheet is declining, we actually don't know how long the QT program is going to go on because neither does the Fed. So that, and actually that's not dissimilar to the situation that the Fed confronted when I was there in 2018 and 2019 as well.
Great. Thank you, Rich. And maybe I'll just summarize some of the key points that we've shared thus far in terms of, you know, PIMCO's broad economic and macro outlook. So number one, we do see inflation moderating. And despite some hotter than expected data recently, we do believe that the Fed will be successful in bringing inflation down. There's obviously a question as to, you know, how quickly or how restrictive or how high rates need to be in order to do that. But that is our base case. Number two, we do see the economy contracting. We do think that a mild recession is possible. And you talked about this, Rich, already in terms of, you know, we might see a technical recession, but it might be that the annual growth for the year is still positive. And so it might be a recession that also feels very differently from what we've seen in prior periods of recession. And so there is some risk there. And then lastly, I think from an interest rate perspective, you know, I think we're in the camp that, you know, the Fed likely will pause. But at the same time, you know, there is some uncertainty there. And I think you mentioned this as well in terms of, you know, Powell wanting to retain some optionality as the data evolves. But overall, this is a fairly constructive outlook for fixed income, notwithstanding some potential uncertainties in terms of, you know, the story around how restrictive or how high rates need to be. Is there anything you'd add to that sort of overall outlook from a macro and inflation perspective?
I think you summarized it quite well.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to take a slightly longer term view. So we've spent a lot of time discussing the next, call it, 3 to 12 months in terms of the outlook. But let's look further ahead. And one question that we do get a lot is about the Fed's inflation target, and given that obviously inflation has been perhaps stickier than many would expect, as you look perhaps beyond the period we're in today, do you see a world where the Fed might change that 2% inflation target to say 3% or something, you know, maybe closer to where we might be landing?
It's a good question because the Fed, like other central banks, including the central bank in Mexico, is an inflation-targeting central bank, which means it defines success as getting inflation to target. And the Fed, like many other advanced economy central banks, selected an inflation target of 2%. I often get asked, where did that 2% number come from? And the quip you'll often read online is that all of global monetary policy is dictated by an arbitrary decision that New Zealand made in 1991, because New Zealand was the first country to adopt what today we call formal inflation targeting, and they picked the number 2 to define their inflation target. And again, in emerging economies, the targets are oftentimes somewhat higher to reflect the cost structures and the development aspirations of those economies, which is fine. But I actually don't like the term advanced economy because a lot of economies are advanced. So how about the originally rich economies? But in that group of advanced economy, rich economies, the number 2 is an anchor almost everywhere. Now, a number of central banks actually define their target not in terms of a number but a range, and the Fed certainly could, and indeed in the past, considered defining success in terms of a range. And they could well, I think, modify their framework when they review it the next time to essentially redefine the target away from saying the number is 2 to saying we like inflation to reside within a range of 1.75 to 2.25 or something like that, which essentially is saying we would like inflation to converge to 2, but we recognize that that because of shocks and other things, it's going to be fluctuating. But if you talk about moving to the next step, which would be to actually have the Fed revise up the target or the center of the target range to 3%, I think that would be very challenging for them because it would be perceived, and I think correctly so, as essentially, you know, changing the rules of the game once you've already not succeeded under the original rules. And Jay Powell has been asked about this on at least 2 occasions last year, and he's given a very crisp one-word, two-letter answer. Chair Powell, would you consider raising the inflation target to 3%? And he says no. So I think that would be a heavy lift. I don't see the Powell Fed doing that, but they could certainly, in light of the experience of this cycle, redefine the target in terms of a range centered on 2.
And is it possible, maybe from just a shorter term perspective, could the Fed just be more comfortable with, say, inflation at 2.8 or 2.7 for some period of time, and not necessarily pushing to get to 2? I've heard you mention that a couple times. Is perhaps maybe where we end up even in this current period?
So yes, Barbara. I think that the way I really since last year. The way I've been thinking about this rate hike cycle is there is an intermediate destination and there's the long run destination. So you sort of think if you ever have been on a vacation with your kids and you get in the back of the station wagon, you know, you're not going to get from Connecticut to Disney World in one night. So you stop somewhere along the way. So I do think that the Fed's not going to try to get from 5% inflation to 2 by next year. I think realistically, it's what I've called the 2-point-something destination. Ideally, they'd like something to be like, you know, 0.3 or 0.2, but it might be 0.7 or 0.8. And I think at that point, they'll recognize, look, inflation's come down a lot. We put in place a tight policy. Almost certainly, if inflation's down in the 2s, you've seen a rise of the unemployment rate and a slowdown in the labor market. And I think it'd be perfectly acceptable there to not continue going on with hiking rates until you get inflation to 2. I think they'll be comfortable with that so long as inflation expectations, as measured either by market prices or surveys, so long as inflation expectations are staying closer to 2. I think they would not be pleased if inflation gets to, say, 2.75% next year and inflation expectations drift up to that number. So part of the bargain for the 2-point-something destination is that the Fed believes and the markets expect that inflation will continue to fall because of the delayed effect of the tightening in place.
Thank you. Another question, looking again forward beyond the cyclical period, there's been a lot of commentary about perhaps some structural changes, deglobalization, the move to reshoring, nearshoring, ESG, and how some of these factors might be leading us to just a very different regime going forward, where maybe inflation is just going to be higher than what we've seen, because a big disinflationary force over the past several years has been globalization. So what is your view on that? Do you give a lot of credence to that view, or what are some of the factors that you're looking at as it relates to those longer term trends?
Excellent point, and I suspect will be a topic that we discuss at length in our secular forum in May. So I don't want to front run where that ends up. But no, speaking for myself, you know, clearly a very long-lasting and persistent shift in the global economy looking ahead compared to the pre-pandemic experience is countries around the world, not just the U.S., are both as a matter of policy from the capital, but also as a matter of business practice by multinationals, are really rethinking the supply chain outsourcing model, especially relevant for, you know, trade in goods as opposed to services. And so it onshoring and friendshoring is inevitable. In terms of the way that impacts the Fed, I think the honest answer, it may not be satisfying to this crowd, I really think it's too soon to tell. And the reason is as follows. To the extent that the cost, the upfront cost of moving from the existing outsourcing model to friendshoring or onshoring model, is a one-time, perhaps substantial cost, you know, moving the factory and all of that, then that's not necessarily inflationary. It's just essentially a fixed cost of changing the model. But if onshoring and friendshoring means that the gains in productivity and the downward pressure on prices that we saw in the old model were to diminish, that doesn't necessarily change the inflation outlook, but it does change the outlook for how tight a monetary policy the Fed needs to run to get to its inflation objectives. Let me give you an arithmetic example. And I bring this up because I remember it was one of my first conversations with Jay Powell after I joined as vice chair. And we were looking at data on inflation in the U.S., and that data is around 2% in most years. And we then decomposed that data in inflation in services prices and inflation in goods prices. And what we saw in the U.S., and I think this is true in a lot of countries, is that in a year when inflation was 2%, what was going on behind the scenes is that services inflation was 3% and goods inflation was minus 1%. And so the way the Fed got to a 2% inflation was that neither good nor services inflation equaled 2, but they averaged to 2 because of goods disinflation. And goods disinflation was being driven by, as we all know, globalization, bringing China into the world trading system and all of that. And also from the U.S.'s perspective, a very, I think, mutually positive relationship with Mexico and Canada in NAFTA. So one of the reasons why there's been such a big inflation overshoot during the pandemic is that the relative prices of goods to services skyrocketed in 2020. You know, people couldn't take vacations or necessarily weren't going to restaurants, and so they just went out and bought a car or bought a big screen TV so they could stream more stuff on TV. And goods price inflation is positive. It's coming down, but it's still contributing to inflation. So this is going to play out over probably a decade or more. I think it's too soon to tell what its impact on prices and the Fed is, but I think we know the direction of the effect. It's just what's the magnitude.
Thank you. And I see that we already have a number of questions from the audience. And in case you missed it, you do have a note card, hopefully, on your table if you want to write in any questions. I'm going to turn to a few of the questions that we've received, which are just looking at the first one here, which is a really good one that I know you've written about on PIMCO.com, Rich. So the first question is, there seems to be a significant disconnect between the Fed messaging, which is higher for longer, and what the market seems to believe or interpret. How can the Fed and Chairman Powell improve messaging? And do you think there's something that could have been better communicated throughout 2022?
Well, the short answer is yes. But I, on average, so I'm still a professor. So on average, I give the Fed and Powell, especially given the degree of difficulty on the test, I would give the Powell Fed pretty good marks on communication on average. But I think there were a couple of missed opportunities. And I've said so publicly on television, so my former colleagues might not be thrilled that I said it. I do think the Fed missed an opportunity in March of last year when it announced its first rate hike, and then also gave guidance through its projections that there was basically a painless disinflation process. Because in those projections, inflation fell by the end of 2023, but interest rates never moved above 3%, and the unemployment rate never moved above 4%. And I think within days, Chair Powell recognized that that was a mistake, that the committee was at real risk of not only falling behind the curve, according to its critics, but legitimately falling behind the curve. And that's thus we got the hawkish Powell pivot. Now, I was at the Fed as Jay's vice chair for a couple of earlier Powell pivots. And one thing I think it tells you about Jay Powell is that he's very pragmatic. And he's a very big believer in the saying, you know, when the facts change, you know, you change your assessment. And so we did get I think the initial communication on the liftoff was a missed opportunity. But I think Powell very quickly, and very commendably, not only put rates on the path where they needed to get and did so at a very aggressive pace, but I thought communicated it very well at the June press conference, the July press conference, the Jackson Hole speech. I had the good fortune of being in Jackson Hole for that. Was excellent. The September press conference, the November press conference. That was all very crisp, and it skewed very hawkish, and that's where we got the line, the risk of doing too little exceeds the risk of doing too much. I would say that as we've gotten closer to the destination, that the messaging has been a little bit less crisp. On the one hand, you know, Jay's a good listener, so sometimes, and especially when he's doing a Q&A or a conversation like this, there will be a bit of on the one hand, on the other, and different folks can interpret that as they want to. But I do think on balance, given the difficulty of the situation that they inherited last year, I think the communication's been pretty good. I do think the upcoming press conference, this is going to sound boring because we always say this, but this is a very important press conference because there'll be a new set of projections. The inflation data, as you said, Barbara, has come in hotter. The labor market data has come in hotter. And the chair will want to acknowledge the macro reality, but he also will want to preserve the optionality not to pre-commit to a succession of rate hikes. And having, you know, briefed and worked with him on, I guess, 32 press conferences during my time there. This is going to be one that we'll be watching closely.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. And this point on the disconnect, you've described it as kind of a tug of war, right, between what the Fed is saying and what the market's pricing in. And it seems, at least in the last few weeks, the market did move, you know, a lot more to price in what the Fed had been saying for some time. And that's also perhaps what creates, you know, opportunities for, you know, investors and, you know, asset managers like PIMCO, because there has been that disconnect, and that's created, you know, volatility as well as opportunities for us to take positions in portfolio to benefit as things perhaps come closer together. Moving on to the next few questions, what do you see as the impact of the delay on the U.S. raising the debt limit? Or I guess the question is about the debt ceiling, and perhaps how that could partially offset quantitative tightening through the Treasury general account channel.
Okay, so so a lot of moving parts here. So one frustrating anachronism about U.S. fiscal and statutory requirements is that the U.S. has a statute passed by Congress decades ago that gives Congress the ability to set a limit on the amount of debt outstanding. Well, that's not on the surface, that sounds fine, but Congress also passes laws for expenditures and taxation. And since the debt is just the difference, the accumulated debt is just the difference between how much you spend and what you collect in taxes, it's a little bit inconsistent. But what it does mean is that, okay, every several years, we have these they always occur when you've got divided government. If you have unified government, the debt limit passes pretty easily. But when you have a president of one party and at least one House of Congress in a different party, the minority party in Congress uses the debt limit as leverage to try to get what it wants elsewhere in the budget. Now, the most dramatic example of that we saw was in the summer of 2011, which is the closest, at least in my adult life, that we've actually come to having the debt limit mean that the Treasury would miss making interest payments on its obligations. And in that episode, the Republicans, who control both houses of Congress, basically extracted from the Obama administration an agreement on some tight restrictions on outlays. So our bottom line, again, here I'm relying on the good work of our Washington expert, Libby Cantrell at PIMCO, who writes about this a lot on the website if you're interested in more detail in our views. But our view is like every time, I think this has happened 60 times since 1950. So the debt limit will get resolved. The U.S. is not going to default on its debt. But the path from here to there is going to be bumpy, and there'll be a lot of twists and turns. But in the end, now in terms of the sort of the more specific part of that question, what happens then when the debt limit is close to binding is that the Treasury cannot issue, they can issue debt to replace debt that has matured, but they can't issue net new debt. So what they start to do is the Treasury has a checking account in essence at the Fed, and it starts to draw that down. If you lost your job, you make your mortgage payment by drawing down your checking account, your savings account, and that's what the Treasury's doing now. In terms of QT, I don't think there's any direct implication for QT. I might be missing something here, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be relevant. In fact, since you asked, if anything, it goes the other direction, because when the Treasury draws down its checking account, those reserves then enter the banking system, and that gives the Fed actually room to extend QT. But I don't think they would essentially use that as a metric, because that's going to eventually get resolved when the debt ceiling gets resolved.
And so the base case on the debt ceiling is that it is raised. We're probably going to see a lot of headlines, a lot of brinkmanship, but we're just in a very different political scenario today than we were the last time, in terms of even just the fiscal hawks and the Tea Party and a lot of that in the U.S. has receded somewhat, which I think just sets things up to ultimately being raised, but potentially some just volatility, especially in kind of the days and weeks leading up to it. Two additional questions on inflation, and we haven't spent a ton of time on China. And so one obviously big development recently has been the reopening. And so could you see a scenario where inflation is more sticky because of the China reopening, in particular due to pressure on commodities?
Yeah, so certainly a big macro story for this year is, after a period of zero COVID in China, that there is a reopening. And it looks like, according to our analysis and others, that we could see a return to growth, GDP growth in China in the range of 5 to 6%. And because China is such a big part of the global economy, obviously that is going to spill over into the rest of the global economy. The thinking of our EM team and our China experts is, compared to other cycles where we've seen rapid growth in China, this cycle may put somewhat less upward pressure on global inflation and commodity prices because the composition of that growth in demand will be skewed less towards capital spending and, you know, building factories and apartment buildings, and more on meeting pent-up demand for consumer services. So it'll be less import and commodity intensive. That's the theory anyway. We'll actually find out as we go through the year, but our baseline view is China reopening is probably, compared to past cycles, going to have somewhat less of a an effect on global growth and inflation.
Yeah, and more on the services piece of it, which is very domestic to China. And if you have any other questions, I know my colleagues were walking around, and they can collect them, and we can make sure to get to them. And again, another question on inflation. Some have argued that the response of the Fed to perhaps pull back the increase in inflation arrived a bit late. And it also seems that fiscal policy was a very key driver, especially, you know, as we think about the fiscal package in 2021. Do you think we should start discussing the role of fiscal policy and how that could influence the trajectory of inflation, or how do you think about that?
Well, absolutely. And I think starting with Chair Powell, has been very clear that the reason why we got the surge in inflation is that the economy hit its supply constraints much earlier than we and presumably fiscal authorities thought. And as a consequence, that meant that the level of aggregate demand in the economy, supported by the Fed and fiscal policy, was making the economy run too hot. And so the Fed's doing its part by raising rates and shrinking its balance sheet and doing QT. But institutionally, the Fed does not give advice on fiscal policy. It takes fiscal policy as an input. Jay Powell is not meeting with members of Congress to tell them what to put in spending or tax packages. But certainly what it does mean is, after the fact, one reason why we got the inflation surge in 2021 was that, in addition to the fiscal stimulus put in place in 2020, there's incremental fiscal outlays in 2021, both through the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill that passed passed later. And then in addition, you essentially had fiscal stimulus last year because a lot of the fiscal transfers received in 2020 and 21 had been saved. And so essentially you had additional support to demand through those excess saving. So I think the Fed will take fiscal policy as an input, and that will be relevant in determining how rapid the disinflation happens and what level of rates the Fed needs to get to.
Yeah. Thank you, Rich. A few more questions. And this is also one that's a little bit more longer term, and it relates to the new neutral rates. And I know we're going to be discussing this at our secular forum in May. But the question is, have there been structural changes in the U.S. economy, which would mean that neutral rates perhaps should be higher, are higher? What would be sort of the factors perhaps in support of that view, the factors maybe in the opposite direction? And importantly, what does the Fed think?
Yeah. Well, so let's just, because it's a relatively esoteric economic term. So what do we mean when we talk about a neutral rate? At the most basic level, the neutral interest rate is the rate that the Fed would like to be setting in an economy that is at its inflation and employment objectives. So concretely, the neutral rate is the rate that you want to be having policy set at when you're actually already at your destination. Before the global financial crisis in the U.S., it was thought, and the Fed behaved as though the neutral policy rate in the U.S. was somewhere in the fours. And when rates were above 4%, that was restrictive. And when rates were below 4%, that was accommodative. And indeed, on average, between 1992 and 2007, the average federal funds rate was 4%. So a lot of evidence that in the pre-GFC, neutral policy rates were around 4. So PIMCO's new neutral thesis, which we published in May of 2014, is that we were in a world, and we thought we'd continue to be in a world in which neutral rates were a lot lower. And what we said is between 2 and 3%, and we call that the new neutral. Now, when that thesis was first published, it was very much an out-of-consensus call, because at that time the Fed was publishing its dots, which showed that the Fed believed that neutral was still 4. And, you know, in the end, someone blinked and it wasn't PIMCO. So in the end, the Fed in the last cycle got the funds rate up to 2.5%. And at that point, we determined that was roughly neutral for that economy. So the question is, post-pandemic, could that change? And the short answer, of course, it could change. A lot of the factors contributing to lower neutral rates are still very much in evidence. Demographics is an inexorable force. People, if you haven't noticed, you get older every day. And so demographic dynamics have not changed. Neutral rates also tend to be related to productivity growth, and we've certainly not seen a pickup in productivity growth. On the other hand, there are some elements of the post-pandemic global economy that could put upward pressure on neutral rates. And in particular, if you believe that we are entering an era of a huge increase in investment driven by the desire to adopt green technologies, or perhaps to have infrastructure investment to complement and support those green technologies, or onshoring where investment is done in the U.S., and certainly in basic macroeconomics, if there's a shift in investment demand, that other things equal puts upward pressure on neutral rates. And so I know, because I constructed the program, we will be discussing this at our forum, and I don't want to get ahead of where we were. I think the important point, however, is right now the Fed does believe, and we know this from its projections, that when we get on the other side of this inflation surge, that neutral rates are going back to where they were before the pandemic, because the Fed has the dots, if you know, and the long-run dot gives you their view of long-run neutral, and that's still around 2.5%.
Great. Thank you, Rich. So more to come on this as we publish our secular outlook in May. So we're going to wrap up with a few questions, just a little bit more focused on markets and investing and sort of some high-level themes here that have come through on the questions. Are bonds back? Expectations for the longer end of the yield curve. And I think this speaks to the fact that obviously the curve is inverted and has been flat at certain points. So how are we thinking about that? And so maybe we'll cover those, and then we'll do a quick wrap up.
Okay. Well, I guess it won't surprise you to hear me say that bonds are back. That was the theme of our December cyclical outlook. But essentially all that means is if you're a bond investor, a year ago, the yield or the coupons on the bonds in your portfolio were quite low because interest rates had been low and obviously the effects of the pandemic. And obviously, as I alluded to earlier in one of my answers to the earlier questions, you know, last year was a disruptive year for markets. We had a very hawkish pivot by the Fed. So not only the direction of travel was very hawkish, but the fact that the Fed essentially had to pivot in the middle of the year added a lot of volatility to markets. And so none of us want to spend a lot of time remembering that. But again, according to our December forum thesis, we do think most of the heavy lifting in rates is behind us. And more importantly, a lot of that is now fully priced into the curve. And what you're left with is, if you believe, as we do, that the Powell Fed will get inflation down over time, then the entry yields, whether or not you're looking at treasuries or you're looking at high quality fixed income or other parts of the fixed income universe, the entry yields are very attractive if you believe, as we do, that inflation is coming down and that over time rates are coming down, because if they are, that opens up the door to capital appreciation in addition to the starting yield. And historically, and there have been dozens if not hundreds of studies on this, the best single predictor of return on a fixed income investment is the initial coupon or yield that you enter the investment in. So for all those reasons, we do think bonds are back. Finally, one of the things that we saw last year that was, you know, a symptom and evidence of the disruption of moving to a hawkish policy was that the hedging value of a fixed income portfolio in an asset allocation strategy did not pay off. What that simply means is that between the mid-90s and last year, in a year when riskier returns were low, say equity returns were low or negative, bond returns tended to be positive because yields were falling. That fell apart last year because the common shock in both equity and bond markets was rates were going up. But if you think, again, as we do, we're close to the end of this cycle, then we do believe that the hedging value of fixed income in an asset allocation portfolio returns. So, yes, bonds are back.
And that point on the starting yield being a pretty valuable predictor of forward-looking returns over a medium-term horizon is one that, you know, we've referenced many times. And then on the long end of the curve, because obviously a lot of the moves from that the market has had in terms of pricing in Fed policy have been, you know, a bit more focused on the short end. And we've talked in prior discussions on the fact that there's been very little term premium. And so how do you think about the rest of the yield curve in this environment?
Excellent point, because historically investors who have allocated their fixed income budget towards longer maturity bonds have benefited from that. They've earned what economists call a positive term premium, which is simply the difference between the expected return to buying a long maturity bond compared to taking less interest rate risk and just rolling over, you know, T-bills. For a variety of reasons, including quantitative easing in the last decade and some important changes in the global economy, the at least economist estimates of the term premium were greatly diminished in the last decade. In fact, according to some estimates, actually went negative. When you have a negative term premium, that says that long duration investors are not receiving any premium for taking on that additional interest rate risk. So I'll share with you, I vividly remember I had the good fortune of overlapping with our PIMCO's founder, Bill Gross, for the first 8 years of my career there. And I do vividly remember an investment committee meeting with Bill, actually during a period of an inverted yield curve, where he pounded the table and he said, capitalism requires a positively sloped yield curve. And so I won't get into whether or not capitalism requires it, but that's typically what we've had. And certainly, you know, our thinking, and more specifically my thinking, is that if anything, one of the differences in the post-pandemic global economy is there will be a return to a positive and healthy term premium on longer-term debt, if for no other reason that there's a lot of Treasury debt that has to be held now because of the big budget deficits that were incurred during the pandemic. So in general, if there's a greater supply of an asset that's got to be held, that'll tend to lower its price and increase its return premium. That would be another factor that's good for bond investors if we see it.
Great. Thank you, Rich. So we're going to start the end of our discussion, because I know we've gone the full hour, and we have this tradition at PIMCO that we do a couple more rapid fire questions at the end, where it might be hard to answer these with one word answers, but shorter.
I'll do my best.
Shorter answers. What are you most proud of during your work at the Fed?
Well, that's more than one word answer, but I'm
unfair question.
I'm proud of the fact that we were pragmatic and we allowed the labor market to blossom and for millions of folks to get a job and get a raise, and we didn't artificially try to throw people out of work because our models were saying the unemployment rate can't go below 5.
Okay, great. What do you miss most from your role as vice chair?
I miss the collegiality. The PAL Fed was a very collegial place. The first 2 years I was there was in person. We'd walk down the hall. It's a very you know, people have said it's a bubble, but because of the nature of the job, you can't go to a lot of cocktail parties and talk about what you're doing during the day. So you tend to bond with your colleagues and the staff, and I do miss that. During the pandemic, we went to work from home monetary policy in March of 2020. So we still had the camaraderie, but it was on WebEx and Zoom screens. So I do miss that. Yeah.
What keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night?
One word.
Seasonal adjustment.
And then last one. This is not your first time in Mexico City, but it's your first time in some time. What are you enjoying the most of the city?
Everything, the weather, the people, the art. I had forgotten what incredible urban architecture you have here. I think just in the 2 days I've been here, I've seen like a dozen buildings that just have a wow factor, and the food. So I love everything.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up here, and I just want to thank you all for being here today with us. We hope we answered many of your questions. I know I didn't get to all of them, but if you included your name, we'll try to follow up with you directly. And thank you again for the trust, for the partnership. Really appreciate it. And Rich, thank you for your time this morning. And thank you to Beva for allowing us to host this event here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias por haber estado con nosotros en este episodio especial de Análisis Beva. Si el episodio fue de su agrado, los invitamos a dejar una reseña, un like en cualquiera de las plataformas desde la que nos escuchen o compartirlo a sus contactos y amigos. Si están viendo este podcast a través de YouTube, no olviden suscribirse a nuestro canal para recibir notificaciones de las próximas publicaciones. La producción de este podcast estuvo a cargo de Rogelio Unzueta. Agradecemos a nuestros ingenieros en audio y video, Héctor García y Bartolomé Chanona. Los acompañó Salvador Leal. Y esto fue Análisis Beva. Hasta la próxima.
La Bolsa Institucional de Valores presentó Análisis Beva. Suscríbete a nuestro podcast y síguenos en todas nuestras redes sociales.